Good afternoon, Juneau. In a couple of seconds, it'll be 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, going to be your host today for Juneau Afternoon. We've got a great lineup of guests today. We're going to first hear a little update on UAS activities, and then Ann Fuller is going to step into the studio and interview a friend of hers, Catherine Rue, Juneau author, now living in New York, who has a novel for young readers and is here in town to do a signing on Sunday the 24th at Hearthside Books. Rob Royce has been selected as Best of Show in the Alaska Watercolor Society show, and will be here to tell us about his work. And we'll also be hearing from the musical menu at this week's Food Truck Friday. We'll be in here, and then there's a special movie coming up at the Goldtown Theater, and so we'll be hearing from the folks at Goldtown. Right now it's time for National Native News. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Seneca Nation in western New York has made indigenous landscaping official policy. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein reports.
Longtime nursery owner Ken Parker asked at a Seneca Nation meeting why Dutch bulbs were to be planted at a new traffic circle.
I suggested that that doesn't really represent our Seneca culture.
That's led to a new policy of indigenous landscaping on nation-owned property, replacing Norwegian maples with sugar maples, hydrangeas with bush honeysuckle, and American hazelnut. Parker, who's now the Seneca Nation's horticultural consultant, says native plants, like native people, are in the minority.
I think it's important that a lot of the territories, that's the last remaining resource, is our plants. It's a natural resource.
Parker says native plants can be used for medicine and food, as well as ornamentation. Parker's hoping to help other tribes start planting more of what's native to their territories. He'll be attending the Intertribal Nursery Council Conference next month in Boise, Idaho. For National Native News, I'm David Summerstein in Canton, New York.
Tribal and non-tribal fishers are concerned about a proposed coal terminal in Oregon. This week, the state denied a permit to the company Amber Energy, seeking the project on the Columbia River. Chuck Sams with the Confederated Umatilla Tribe says the decision by the Department of State Lands honors not only a 160-year-old treaty, but the modern-day realities of tribal fishing.
Since the building of the dams, many of the fish, when they travel up and down the river, don't necessarily travel the main channel or the main stem. They travel along the sides. In this particular case, the proposed site is a very active fishing site for tribal fishermen.
Coal trains and more barges would affect salmon fisheries, river safety and recreation, say fishermen, like Bob Reese with the Association of Northwest Steelheaders.
Coal worldwide, you know, is still having impacts on the Pacific Northwest ecosystems. The export of cheap coal is just going to continue to encourage third world countries to utilize it as an energy source. That's something that we can't be a part of.
The Umatilla tribes are a major employer in the region and recognize a big construction project would bring a spike in jobs, but say the boost would be temporary and longer-term economic development solutions are needed. Amber Energy is considering options to move forward with its plans. Arts and culture mean tens of thousands of jobs and billions of dollars to New Mexico's economy, according to a recent study. The state, with a rich culture, includes 22 tribes. Troy Wild has more.
Dr. Shel Sanchez is with the State Department of Cultural Affairs, which conducted the study titled Building on the Past, Facing the Future, Renewing the Creative Economy. She says it shows that a good number of all jobs in New Mexico are within arts and culture.
Almost 10% of jobs, that's primary income jobs, not secondary incomes, come from the arts and cultural industries. So in New Mexico, that's over 75,000 jobs, which is a lot for New Mexico because we're a relatively small state in terms of population.
Sanchez adds that jobs within arts and culture include everything from film and television production to people working as artists in art galleries and also educators within the arts. To illustrate the economic impact of arts and culture, the study points out that it employs more people than New Mexico's construction and manufacturing industries combined. And Sanchez says research shows that having a strong arts and culture community is also helpful in attracting new businesses that want a certain quality of life for their employees. I'm Troy Wild.
Two native art markets are taking place in New Mexico. The indigenous fine art market started Thursday at the Santa Fe Rail Yard. The first ever three-day event features native artists and the stage for performers. The indigenous fine art market was formed after a split with staff members from the Southwestern Association for Indian Arts, or SWIA. Meanwhile, SWIA events kicked off Monday, and the Indian market begins this weekend, which draws in artists and collectors and millions of dollars to the economy. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Not voting is not rebelling. It's surrendering. Your voice counts when you vote. First, you have to register. Find out more at nativevote.org. Brought to you by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's just coming up on 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon, but I have a co-host today, which is really kind of cool. Ann Fuller is here, and she has had a past history of reading books by our next guest, who's in town for a wonderful little book signing that's going to happen on Sunday, the 24th of August, at Hearthside Books. So Catherine Rue is here. She's got a book out entitled Carly Keene, Literary Detective, Braving the Brontes. This is kind of an interesting literary work here. So here's Ann Fuller and Catherine Rue.
Hello, Catherine. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me, Ann.
Oh, you're welcome. So I have the book in my hands, and I would call it a chapter book.
Yeah, middle grade chapter book. The protagonist is 12.
Right, and so usually that means kids up to about 12 will really love the book.
Yes, I'd say 9 to 12 would be the target audience.
Okay, and is this your first published work?
It is my first published work, and I'm still trying to believe it a little bit. Sort of, I had all the fun of writing it, and now all of a sudden it's out in the world, and oh my.
And it's right here in physical form. I think it came out as an e-book a little earlier.
It did come out a little earlier. The printers and my publishers were having a little back and forth, so the paperback took a little bit longer than we'd hoped.
All right. So it's, and I have read it. I read it. And I think it's great fun, and it will certainly appeal to the girls who like time travel, historical fiction, and people who are reading everything they can get their hands on. Is that sort of who you thought would want to read it?
Yes, that is definitely who I thought would want to read it, and that's who I was, certainly. And I have to admit, my parents were like, we recognize a few things about Carly. And I said, well, there is a major difference. Carly brushes her hair. I'm not sure that I was willing to do that at 12, but
yes. So, and there's an argument about what to wear in wet weather.
Yes.
That I think I heard was also an argument you recall.
True to life, yes. I would always say, oh, but fleece is so much more comfortable. And my parents would say, oh, but wool is self-extinguishing and won't burn unless you're actually in the fire.
Right. So I wanted to have you tell us a little bit about growing up as a writing person. Now, you lived in Juneau as a girl, right?
Yeah, born and raised, although I did spend 6 years in Anchorage when I was very small. But born in Juneau, born at Bartlett, here all the way at JDHS, because there was no Thunder Mountain at that point. Class of 99, probably the best class they've ever had, I have to say. But yeah, it was amazing. I loved it. It was the perfect place to grow up because you just could go read books when it was raining and then go mess around in the woods and play. And it was just so wonderful. And so it's great being back here. I have two small children now and visiting my parents and just seeing them get to experience Alaska the way I did is wonderful.
Oh, that sounds good. Sounds great for a summer trip. And while you're here, I know you went to the Douglas Library last week and gave a talk. And then this weekend, on Sunday, you're going to be signing books at Hearthside. Is that downtown?
Yes, downtown from 1 to 3, although if there's a line, I will continue to sign, I promise.
Oh, good. And the Juno Connection, what I hadn't known was something about the editor.
Oh,
so tell us,
yes.
Who helped you. You wrote it.
I wrote it, and then, you know, publishers have editors on staff to work with their authors and help them get their books into shape, ready for public viewing, as it were. I'm very glad nobody other than my editor and publishers have read the first draft of Carly Keene. But the editor is actually one of my best friends from growing up and is from Juno and currently lives in Juno, Genevieve Gagne-Haas, and she's an amazing editor, works both here and in New York City. And we had a very funny conversation because the publisher said, Genevieve has done amazing work on our other books. We would like her to edit your book. We want to make sure you're both comfortable with that since you are, in fact, you know, longtime friends, and we wouldn't want that to be sort of awkward, or she wants you to make this change and then you guys have a giant fight or something. And I said, no, I think we'll be fine. And it turned out it was a really fun process for both of us. Oh. And it was an amazing experience to be edited by someone as talented as she is. And hopefully I did her edits justice.
Oh, thank you. That's a gracious thing to say. So just as you described some of the things you love best about Juno growing up, that's how the book opens. Carly is in Juno, and then it's raining. She's reading a book, and she's transported back to the moors.
Yes, in England.
England.
In 1846.
And so what kind of research did you have to do to be able to spend the rest of the time on the moors?
The rest of the book practically back in the moors of Yorkshire. Well, luckily I'd read endless children's books about the moors in Yorkshire, you know, Secret Garden, mm-hmm. all of those wonderful Anglophile books. And then preparatory to writing this, I read a lot about the Bronte family, you know, Charlotte, Emily, Anne, Branwell, their brother, the parents. There's a very good young adult biography of them just out, which I was able to read. It came out sort of most of the way through my research, but I was able to read it before I finished the final draft of Carly. And then there's also about 1,000-page biography of them that had just been updated and sort of re-released in hardcover as I was doing this. It was perfect. I was able to, it's the size of a giant doorstop, but it covers their childhood on the moors, their terrible time at boarding school, where two of their sisters actually die of typhoid and consumption. It's absolutely horrible, mm-hmm. tuberculosis. And then on into their later lives and their writing careers, and which were very dramatic, their books. So Charlotte wrote Jane Eyre, her sister Emily wrote Wuthering Heights, and then their sister Anne wrote Agnes Grey, and they were all published in a very short time period and were very controversial in Victorian England.
Controversial. Because nowadays, most of us have heard of the Brontes and think,
Brontes.
Everybody, we're supposed to read them. And then some of us do discover that they make for great reading because they're exciting. But at the time they were published, they were controversial.
They were very controversial, mostly because of the very dramatic emotions that the female protagonist experience. And that they're sort of demanding happiness. And there was a great movie there's been many wonderful movie adaptations, especially of Jane Eyre, but also Wuthering Heights. And there was one pretty recently, and it really captures sort of how shocking it was for women to sort of demand happiness and power in their own lives and to have passion and all of those things. And so the Bronte sisters, they laid it all out there in Victorian society, said, oh my. but they bought the books and they loved them.
They did love the books. That's what people wanted to read.
Yes.
And people are still reading the books and enjoying them. I think that's one of the reasons that Carly Keene exists, or why do we have such a literary detective?
We have such a literary detective because I think there's a real gap for readers like I was and many of my friends were, where you've read great children's books, like, say, Anne of Green Gables or Little Women or the Narnia books, or now they have Harry Potter, which is awesome. We had to wait book by book for it to come out. But there's then sort of a gap where maybe you haven't discovered books like Jane Eyre. Maybe you aren't quite old enough. Maybe you're about to be. And I wanted there to be a bridge and to say to people, look, here is, you know, I wrote Carly Keene to be a book that I would have wanted to read when I was 12 or 9 or 15. But I also wanted it to show people what was coming next and that there were exciting, wonderful books coming up on their horizon that were going to be so much fun and just play such an important part of their reading life.
Right. And after all, the Brontes don't have the action figures and the toy tie-ins of Disney characters these days. So some publicity for the classics?
Exactly. A little publicity for the classics to say, you know, they're even more exciting. There's a lot of drama and angst in Wuthering Heights. They're a little crazy, I'm not going to lie.
Right. And so this is one of those counterfactual books. I mean, I don't think that I truly believe that a modern-day girl from Juneau went back to the Moors and changed literary history.
I don't know, Anne. Do you know what I was doing at 12? No, I'm just kidding. I wish. That's the problem.
It might have happened. And so you've nestled this story in what we know and are providing lots of details. And I was going to ask you, you talked about being able to research the parsonage, which is where the sisters were living at the time, with this modern technology. So tell us about that.
So I was so happy to find out that the Bronte Parsonage, it's preserved as a museum. You can go visit it if you're in Yorkshire, England. But it's also, they've put a video tour of it online. So if you go, it's called Haworth, Haworth Parsonage, and that's also the name of the village. And if you go onto their website, if you Google them, you can see the dining room where the sisters would walk, pace around and around the table at night writing their stories, and they'd pause and scribble down something, and then they'd continue all together to pace around and talk things over, a sort of literary genius family. Mm-hmm. So you can see the whole thing, and so I was able to walk myself through to make sure I put the staircase in the right place, and that I put the bedrooms on the right side of things and what they'd be looking out over, which was really great since I couldn't jet off to England for the weekend, sadly.
No. Well, I hope you do get there someday to see it.
Yes.
Where you did it. You know, the most wonderful thing about a book is actually the story. And so I think maybe we've done enough talking right now. And I wondered if I could ask you to read a section. I love some of the struggles this modern girl has back in such conventional life. And here is a section that I've asked you to read.
Yes, it starts on page 78. And Charlotte is Carly's governess in the general plot of things. And she says, Charlotte made a visible effort to collect herself. Caroline, there is some urgent business I must see to. Go and practice the piano for half an hour, then work on your French verbs. With that, the sisters swept into Mr. Bronte's study and shut the door. Carly stood for a minute longer in the hall, in case anything else interesting was going to happen, but the door remained closed. Upstairs, Carly went dutifully to the piano, but before she could pick out a piece, the door banged open and Branwell strode in. His red hair stood on end and his neckcloth was in disarray, as though he had been tugging at it. He didn't appear to notice Carly, but instead rooted in a cupboard in the corner of the room, muttering to himself. Where is it? I know I hid it somewhere. How dare he write back? Emily knows that man isn't half as clever and charming as he thinks he is, even if he did call her a genius. But how to make Charlotte see? I can't think in this stuffy house. Where is it? Ah! With this exclamation, Carly saw him pull a bottle out of the cupboard. Branwell hurried from the room without once looking at the piano bench where Carly sat, frozen. What in heaven's name was happening? Carly knew from conversation around the dining room table that Charlotte had recently returned from Brussels in Belgium, where she and Emily had studied French and taught literature and music. Emily always ended discussions of their time abroad by saying dramatically, I could never be parted from my beloved Moors again. I'd rather starve. Charlotte never said she missed Brussels, but the subject seemed to depress her. Carly idly played scales, her fingers moving up and down the keys while she thought. There was something the matter with Charlotte. and not just the worry all three sisters felt about Branwell and his drinking and laudanum use. When grown-ups didn't want to let kids see what was wrong, Carly thought, it usually meant the trouble lay with their hearts. She mulled this over. Had Charlotte been showing signs of heartache? Would Carly know what those signs looked like if she saw them? Maybe not. This is why it would have been useful to have an older sister or brother, Carly thought. Then she could have observed what being in love looked like firsthand. As it was, Carly was used to people who said what they meant, whereas everyone here seemed to speak about their feelings in code. It was very vexing. And what about the letter that had just arrived? Did that give her any clues? It was from Brussels, where Charlotte had been until recently. Anne was worried, Emily was angry, and Charlotte was upset. Mr. Bronte sounded angry, too. They all seemed to think the letter was from a man, but Anne's idea that it was maybe from the man's wife had been met with even more horror. What could be in that letter, wondered Carly. In her experience, letters were fun. You got them on your birthday and from your favorite cousin who lived in Virginia. They didn't make everyone in the house panic.
Thank you. That's a section of Carly Keene, Literary Detective, an example of how the plot is not like an action hero, but it certainly moves along, and I was quite fascinated with it. So we're here with Catherine Rue, who wrote this book, has a contract for a next adventure with Carly Keene, and will be signing copies of this first book at Hearthside Books downtown on Sunday at 1 o'clock. I think that you've done a great job, Catherine, and I'm glad you came in to talk to us. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Just that I hope that you enjoy reading it as much as I had fun writing it. And the next one will also sort of start in Alaska, and we'll adventure from there.
Adventure from there. Do you know who the literary connection is?
Absolutely. It's going to be Louise May Alcott, but not as you're suspecting with Little Women. It's going to be while she's a nurse during the Civil War. So there's going to be quite a bit of actual action this time, because they're going to be caught up in the Battle of Fredericksburg and various other overly exciting events, probably, if you're in them.
All right. Well, this sounds like an adventure for you, too.
You've been listening to a conversation between Ann Fuller and Catherine Rue. Catherine is a former Junoite, author of a new book, Carly Keene and the Carly Keene Literary Detective, Braving the Brontes. Signing is 1 o'clock at Hearthside Books here in Juneau on Sunday. So go buy a copy, take it over, get it signed. A little music now.
The Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 22nd of August, 2014. 1864, on this date, 12 European countries signed the first Geneva Convention. It was the idea of Henri Dunant, the founder of the International Red Cross, who had seen the Battle of Solferino in the war for the unification of Italy. He was horrified by the carnage, 40,000 casualties, many of which were just left to die on the battlefield. The Geneva Convention established fair treatment of combatants, the obligation to treat sick and wounded regardless of which side they were on, and the protection of medical personnel. The United States eventually ratified the first Geneva Convention in 1882. It's the birthday of Annie Prue, born Edna Annie Prue in Norwich, Connecticut, 1935. She lived in Vermont as a young woman. She published a newspaper. She wrote how-to books about things like making apple cider and building a fence and hunting and fishing, both of which she loved. Some of the articles written for men's outdoor magazines. These freelance writing jobs taught her how to research things, and she's since made a career writing fiction based on extensive research. Her first novel was Postcards, 1992, and to write that, she traveled back and forth across the country, stopping in all the places where her main character worked and lived. Finished that novel, and she stumbled on a map of Newfoundland. She said, "Each place name had a story, Dead Man's Cove, Seldom Come Bay, Bay of Despair, Plunder Beach." So she explored Newfoundland, she looked at maps, went to bed every night with a Newfoundland vernacular dictionary, and the result was her novel, The Shipping News, which was a bestseller in 1993. Here's a poem for today by Tony Hoagland, "You're the Top." Of all the people that I've ever known, I think my grandmother Bernice would be best qualified to be beside me now, driving north of Boston in a rented car while Cole Porter warbles on the radio. Only she would be trivial and unpolitically correct enough to totally enjoy the rhyming of Mahatma Gandhi with Napoleon Brandy. And she would understand from 1948 the miracle that once was cellophane, which Porter rhymes with night in Spain. She loved that image of the high gay life where people dressed by servants turned every night into the Ritz, dancing through a shower of just uncorked champagne into the shelter of a dry martini. When she was 70 and I was young, I hated how a life of privilege had kept her ignorance intact about the world beneath her pretty feet, how she believed that people with good manners naturally had yachts, knew how to waltz, and dribbled French into their sentences like salad dressing. My liberal adolescent rage was like a righteous fist back then that wouldn't let me rest, but I've come far enough from who I was to see her as she saw herself, a tipsy debutante in 1938, kicking off a party with her shoes, launching the lipstick red high heel from her elegant big toe into the orbit of a chandelier suspended in a lyric by Cole Porter, bright and beautiful and useless. "You're the Top," a poem by Tony Hoagland from Sweet Ruin, published by the University of Wisconsin Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org, and by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 29 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. A special announcement here, if I may, and that is the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge. If you've been watching YouTube at all, you've seen some famous people get a bucket of ice dumped over their head. Well, here in Juneau, we are going to do it slightly differently. It's a sort of a fundraiser donation thing in Lloyd Johnson's memory, an ALS victim. So it's Saturday, August 23rd, tomorrow at 10 in the morning at the L.G. Rayfield Mertz parking lot. That's 9309 Glacier Highway. It's in Professional Plaza. And so the concept here is that you could challenge a friend and watch them get soaked. You bring a bucket and ice and water will be provided. Basically the concept here is to dump a bucket of ice over someone, hopefully someone of great importance to you, someone who will remember the event. And, there is a donation being, collected, and those donations will go toward, helping to cure ALS. So, something interesting to participate in. My next guest is a well-known artist here in Juneau, and Rob Royce has quite a reputation in the abstract arts, and just recently won the Alaska Watercolor Society's Best in Show Award. His piece entitled Imagined Memory will be on display through September 29th in the Blue Holloman Gallery up in Midtown Anchorage. And Rob is here to tell us a little bit about the creation of this piece and maybe some other things about his artistic career. Welcome, Rob.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I think you may be one of a very few abstract artists producing art in Alaska.
There's quite a few. Juneau really? Has a pretty vibrant arts community, and you know, usually the only ones you're hearing about are the ones that do the things that, you know, I call it moose and spruce. There's, you know, tons of us. We just don't get the airplay.
No, you don't get the airplay. Okay, well, here's your big chance. Now you can represent that entire community. So,
absolutely,
you're under a great deal of pressure now to go. So, the other folks who won along here, do you know the other authors, John Svensson, who won first place along the Kambu Highway?
I met John Svensson a long time ago. We had a group show for one of the early December gallery walks in the early 90s, and he had this crazy hat from Tibet. It was this ginormous twirly thing and had gold and silver threads all over it. Uh-huh. And I was like, I got to meet that guy. And, I've met him, and he comes through Juneau occasionally.
Yeah.
He also used to show at Portfolio Arts, which was a gallery here in Juneau for a long time in the early 90s as well. So I
noticed he won first place. He's from Haines. And then second and third place were Anchorage folks. Mark McDermott, a piece called Isis Temple Cheops Pyramid.
Yeah.
And Cheops Pyramid Grand Canyon, I guess. And then Christine Fortner won for the tourist guys, both second and third places. And then there were a number of honorable mentions as well. This Watercolor Society competition now, I believe, in its 40th year?
Yeah, this is the 40th.
Have you entered before?
This is my third time entering.
And did you place in the previous entries?
I'm actually really amazed my pieces made it in, because it seems like every time I've, you know, the prior times I've entered, there's some snafu, the wrong painting got shipped, or the matting wasn't correct or something like this. So this is the first time I've actually had a piece make it into judging and actually be hanging on a wall there. So. Uh-huh.
And so your best in show.
Yeah.
That, you did well on your first completed entry.
it's a surprise. You know, these jury shows, you never know what's going to happen, what they're looking for. A lot of times with a juror, they're coming from out of state, and they have a vision of what Alaska means, and they look for things that fit within that vision of Alaska. So in this case, it's the lucky hand, I guess.
Was there a model for your...
It's actually a friend of mine. Her name's Jennifer Moss. That's her husband, Harper Simmons, and she used to live in town. She's also a painter, does kind of scientifically abstract work. And that's a picture I took of her husband back in the early 90s when I was up visiting him in Fairbanks, and finally made the churn and got to the top, and I did a painting of him. And
If someone wants to see the painting, it's about center spread on a website called Rob Royce, and that's at squarespace.com. But if you just Google robroyce.com, you wind up on the thing. Now, he has an extremely angular face with a prominent nose. And then coming out of one side, you focus first of all, I think, on these eyes that are surrounded with a kind of a gray shading. Mm-hmm. And they give a, it's hard to describe exactly what the expression is. It's fairly neutral in tone, but it has a kind of a curiosity behind it,
uh-huh.
Like he's observing something. And then coming out of the side of what would be his head are four clouds, kind of. And this mm-hmm. is the imagined memory, I should imagine, is kind of how the piece gets its title. Yeah. Although you said you like to mystify people with their titles.
You know, I'm getting better with my titles. Titling is really hard. But the way the painting originally looked, it was him on the flue.
Ah.
I've only known him from Fairbanks. He was also I went to school in Fairbanks and a fellow student up there. So I just had this imagined memory of going on a hike with him on the flu,
mm-hmm.
A little hike walk. And I painted over most of the stuff that's readily identifiable as the flume, and that's where the clouds come from.
Mm-hmm. The face is fascinating. You know, you kind of get locked into this face and you want to see it. For a while, you kind of have to look at it and think what that expression is, or what it is that's going through this person's mind. Interesting guy, is he?
He is a professor of geology, mm-hmm. I think hydrology or whatever the water thing is. Geology, but yeah, he likes to blow things up.
Well,
go hiking.
Well, my kind of guy.
Raises pigs, you know. And makes his own sausage.
Okay. Well, yeah, he sounds like a Fairbanks.
Yes.
true Fairbanks.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, and you said that you drew this from memory then?
Well, I had a photograph, but I just, you know, for me, when I work from a photograph, it's just a reference point to go off and do whatever. Normally, I work from sketches. But for people that I'm just around briefly or seeing in another situation, more social situation, I'll just work from photographs.
Have you done other things with his face?
No, that's the first one.
Okay. There's a whole sequence of art that I've seen that you did that had stars in every piece.
Uh-huh.
Was that your star period or what? Were you going for something particular?
You know, the stars replaced circles.
I
like to do circles, but people were finding... other things in the circles. They thought they were other items. And so I started using stars because it's a little... They're primarily compositional, just to kind of get some lines in there. The way mm-hmm. I work, it's with, you know, I use acrylic as more of a water media type thing, and it comes across looking more like oil paint, but it's definitely more of a wash and draw in. And so the stars, they get layered in there and kind of go back and forth. They'll be on top of things or behind things, and to kind of give a scale and some depth to it. So,
one of the things that you said on your website is that when you work, you will apply paint to one piece, and while you're waiting for it to dry, you'll work on another one.
Yeah.
I'm curious, is that because when you've got the creative thing that you don't want to lose the energy? Or I'm curious as to why you don't take a break. I'd go get a cup of coffee.
I have fizzy water. At the end of the night, I'll have some beer, but it's usually fizzy water. But it's just one of the things that as you're working, you kind of get into a flow. That's mm-hmm. definitely...
So you don't want to break the flow, kind
no,
of?
No, and, you know, you got all your paints out already. You know, it's stuff's expensive. Don't want to waste it. If you take a break, it's going to dry. It's one of the big things with acrylic is that it dries up. And then once it's dry, you can't re-wet it and reuse it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of it. It's more of just conservation of materials as opposed to letting the flow go. But if you're working, you're working.
Where do you work?
I have a studio. I'm currently above Alaska Cash Liquor. I even have a little gallery.
Mm-hmm.
So if anybody wants to see it, they can just email me and I'll bring them on up.
You work from photographs, you work from sketches,
mm-hmm.
But you're in the middle of a little gallery, so you're actually surrounded by your own work.
It's a separate room, but yeah.
Okay, so you're not. I was wondering how much of an echo you get from piece to piece.
Oh,
but and so if you were working in the middle of the gallery, and I know artists mm-hmm. who do, but there's always that danger of not going to a new place because basically you wind up replicating what you're seeing. I think.
Not to compare myself to other great artists, but there, historically, there's been plenty of artists. The one that jumps out to me is Monk, who did The Scream. He did several versions of The Scream and several other paintings. Like, basically all of his famous paintings, he just did multiple versions of and toured Europe with them. And so it's this kind of dual-edged sword. Yeah, you want a style. Yeah, you want your work to be recognizable. But at the same time, you want to be creative and doing new things. So there, you want to have that echo chamber to a point, but you also want to explore everything to its natural conclusion. So you kind of have to refer back to your own work, I think. And I think that's important for me. And it's a good question.
Some of your stuff is accessible here in Juneau.
Uh-huh.
People could come see the stuff in your studio.
Yep.
And again, where is that located?
So I'm above Alaska Cash Liquor, which is right across from El Sombrero.
Oh, okay.
A lot of people know it as the Peabody's Monster Space.
Yeah.
The door is.
You have to have lived here.
Yeah. I share a space with a bunch of musicians, their practice space. And there's an area, it's called Studio X, is the official name of it. And I have Studio X right now. And I've fixed up one of the rooms to as a gallery. And then my studio looks over the street right downtown.
When would someone come by to?
First Fridays,
sure.
7 p.m. and on.
Okay.
We open a little later, so come on by. Yeah.
Yeah. 7 o'clock, and of course you have wine and cheese out.
the rule is there's you can't serve alcohol at a public event, is my understanding.
Oh, okay.
So we usually don't have booze.
Okay, so fizzy water. And
fizzy water, yeah.
Okay, good. All right, so the Rob Roy's official.
I won't be there this time, though. I'll be up in Anchorage.
Yeah, you'll be up in Anchorage. Oh, you're going up for the opening, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And the opening is... on what, September 5th?
Yep.
5 to 8 p.m. if you want to, you know, book a flight and fly up and see the grand opening. Anyway, the piece will be on display at the Blue Holloman Gallery through September 29th. So if you happen to be traveling to Anchorage, I invite you to do. Otherwise, go online to robroys.com and find the piece in the middle of the page of art there. And if you'd like to come around to Rob Roy's and take a look at his work, it's Studio X upstairs over...
Alaska Cash Liquor.
Alaska Cash Liquor downtown. Okay, thank you so much for coming, and congratulations on winning the award.
Thank you.
Stop. It is waiting. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. It's a quarter to four, and you're in tune with us here at Juneau Afternoon. And we are about to talk to Wild Woman Costa here, who has brought another film of great import to the Gold Town Theater. Yeah, so this is the one we've been hearing about quite a bit. This is Boyhood.
Boyhood.
12 years in the making with the same people.
And I was there every step of the way.
You were,
holding
yeah.
his hand.
I'm glad. He needed someone to stand by.
He needed a little boost.
Is this through bilocation? Is that how you did this?
Well, it was more like by echolocation.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I'm like a dolphin.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah. That's how I call my forces in. I'm like,
careful.
Aquaman.
Now we have dolphins coming to the studio.
It's okay.
They're coming along. Okay. So Boyhood is playing when?
Boyhood opened yesterday.
Okay.
And we've got it for at least 2 weeks. If enough of you come and see it, I might hold it an extra week.
Okay.
It's pretty, it's an unprecedented piece of art, but isn't all art derivative of something? So how unprecedented can it really
so,
be?
So, well...
But that aside, so this is Richard Linklater is the director, and he also did Slackers, which, and his whole thing is he's kind of a slacker film director. He kind of makes movies when he's not too lazy to do nothing else. Dazed and Confused was his big one. That's the nice thing about 18-year-old girls. They stay the same age, and I get older. So this is kind of the antithesis of the Richard Linklater movie in that it actually took effort to make. It took 12 years of effort. He's slowly been piecing it together in between his other projects and using this young actor that he met in Texas. She's from Austin, Linklater. And just been filming bits and pieces of it over the years. So it's sort of a page book of a young life. Is the short summation of it.
Yeah. So in the middle of this thing, suddenly the Austin Steamers show up. And these guys are the Panhandle Crabgrass Revival Band, is
well,
that right?
Well, kind of. So this is our little local connection to this giant.
Okay.
And this I have to say, this movie has been getting unprecedented reviews.
Wow.
I've tried to find a bad one, and I can't, which always makes me very suspicious. That makes me think that I'm really not going to like it.
Mm-hmm.
During the filming of this, so there was a musician who lived here, Sean Tracy, lived here for years and years, and he was in a band called the Panhandle Crabgrass Revival Band, the epic, now legendary band. He moved to Austin about 4 or 5 years ago and started a new band called the Austin Steamers, and... they play in a bar down there that I think Richard Linklater heard them playing down there and said, hey, do you guys want to be in the background of one of my scenes? And he ended up cutting them into a scene, and they're actually, about 30, 40 seconds of Old Black Crow is sort of featured in the middle of the scene. So it's a nice little kick.
Now, you've looped this, right? So
over and over.
Over and over and over hour and a half.
So the movie is actually only 30 minutes long, but in our theater it's 2 hours and 44 minutes.
I like the plan.
It's the extended dance version of that. So it's kind of a nice thing. So I'm going to have some CDs of theirs for sale down at the theater to help out the local.
At the end of this little hootenanny we're doing, we'll find ourselves listening to Indeed, that very thing.
You can sample that.
Yeah, yeah. So, but you got, this is not the only film that you're ever going to show.
It never is, Pat. Let me tell you.
So, let's see. We got the Grand Budapest Hotel still in town.
Still. Yeah. And, I keep waiting for Wes Anderson. I've set the world record for longest continuous play of the Grand Budapest Hotel on 35mm film.
Uh-huh.
13 weeks I've had this. To great success, I must say. And still no phone call from Wes.
Well,
so if you're listening, call me.
Yeah.
586-2875. It's a little shameful. I mean, at least Bill Murray could stop by.
You would think, yeah.
Yeah. It's just,
or at least the Guinness people.
I'm starting to think that Hollywood people are full of themselves and they don't care about the little guys.
You may be right.
I'm getting a little jaded, Pat.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie to you.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to hold it. Actually, I'm holding it. I have to kick it out for... I'm getting the new Woody Allen movie, so I got to kick it out in a couple weeks. So it's going to be your last chance to see Ralph Fiennes in a tuxedo. The thinking girl sex symbol.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I have this dream where he and Colin Firth get into a mud wrestling match.
I can tell you're excited.
I digress. So we have, that should be, yeah.
And you got Chaplin.
And we have a little bit of Chaplin.
Mm-hmm.
Very excited. Yep. Very excited. Haven't had a chance to show Charlie Chaplin yet. And
you got anybody playing along with this one?
We're not sure. We're
okay.
Thinking about it.
You got it?
Yeah. We're debating.
Okay.
There might be some people hanging out there in the fringes.
Yeah.
There is a great band playing at the Alaskan this weekend, the Rattle Trap Ruckus.
Yeah.
And you never know where they might show up and play a few
mm-hmm.
tunes. I'm pretty excited about the whole, you know, I love my silent movie series. It's super film geek stuff. But it's also, you know, there's a reason that Chaplin is a legend. And
yeah.
It's because he's brilliant. And the stuff seems a little bit trite now in the way that, you know, Frankenstein seems trite because everyone has now stolen that film language and done it over and over. But, you know, they really were inventing the language of film back then, and he was at the forefront of doing that. And he took things from Mack Sennett and the Keystone Cops where he was working, and he refined them and he polished them, and he just, you know, he really made diamonds out of coal. And he's a comic genius, you know. And on top of that, you know, he was a vaudeville performer, so it's easy to dismiss these things he's doing, but, you know, there's little things where he's being pushed into a barrel, you know, like a bull riding barrel over and over again, which is physically really difficult to do.
Yeah.
I tried doing it. I couldn't even get in it.
And he did his own stunts. So.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, back in the day.
Yeah.
Nobody did stunts.
Yeah, anymore. So we've got Chaplin on Sunday, one show only, or one day only, Sunday at 2, 7:30, and 9. And Grand Budapest will be Saturday at 4? No, Saturday at 2 is Grand Budapest.
Yeah,
and
4 p.m. And 7:30 p.m. are the
yeah.
two showings of.
And then Boyhood is the rest of the weekend.
Right. I'm curious. Do people off the ships drop into your theater?
Not if they're smart, which so few of them are.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I have to say, I had these two cruise ship workers, and they worked at a gift shop, and they came in every single Thursday when they were in town, regardless of what was playing, and they loved coming in. They said, you know, we've been coming to Juneau for years and years, and it just gives us an excuse to get off the boat and do something else.
Yeah.
So occasionally they'll walk in, but, you know, it sort of takes a fairly independent-minded person. The ones who do, I generally sit down and have a great conversation with. I had a guy walk in last week who actually does digital conversions for small theaters.
Uh-huh.
That's his job. So we sat and had a great talk for a while. And
good. Now, this is the area where I wanted to get to, because you mentioned 35 millimeter. You're struggling for survival here.
We are.
Everybody needs to know that. So basically, you're showing films using a 35 millimeter film projector.
Mm-hmm.
And the big guys now are not using that technology anymore.
No.
And you can't convert over for an economical amount of money, right?
No, nothing under $40,000.
Yeah, and yeah. There's this other little trap that they have where they'll give you the equipment, but then they require you to show their movies, right?
Yes, and that little package has sort of come and gone. That ship has sailed.
Okay.
And they weren't interested in mom-and-pop theaters anyway.
Okay.
They were interested in chains and small chains and larger chains. But.
So and nobody's producing on 35.
Well, there's a few that are left. I mean, you know, there's a few of the big studios that are still going to crank out a few 35s, but the two remaining ones have already sent me sort of, you know, shots over the bow that they're winding down.
Uh-huh.
And there's, you know, I'm just sort of keeping a short list now of all the titles I haven't been able to get over the past 6 months to a year. You know, Dallas Buyers Club couldn't get it, you know, and the other theater decided not to bring it in, and got lots of requests and just couldn't do it. So it's becoming more and more imminent, and it's becoming exponentially imminent as the weeks go on.
Colette, what's the plan?
It's a good question, Pat. That's a great question. Well, the plan is to put together a multi-jurisdictional group. well, that's a I the short answer is, huh? What? I need to put together a group of people. Yeah, I feel like it's something that needs to be a little bit outside of me. It's basically a sort of a short-term, full-time job putting that together. We're thinking about a Kickstarter. We're thinking about converting to nonprofit. We're thinking about making a co-op. I'm also in
all of these would be ways to raise the money to convert to digital.
Right, yeah. Right. And then I'm also in conversations with theater owners across the U.S. I mean, there's a thread of theater owners across the U.S., and they've been a great help answering questions just like this. You know, what have you done? What was successful? What wasn't? How did you do it? And hopefully not be one of the, 60,000 theaters that are going to shut down in the next year or so. Because they can't do it.
Yeah.
We have an awesome, awesome town here that supports arts in a great way. And I'm forever in debt to them just as an artist outside of owning the theater. And maybe I'm being optimistic. I don't feel like it's not going to happen. I think that we have a wonderful support group. It's just a matter of lining the ducks up and shooting them off the galley floor and figuring out who's got the biggest gun.
Well, from the wonders that you bring to us, I sure hope something can be worked out, because it would be a terrible shame to lose
Thank you.
This. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
So, a little music to go out with?
Let's go out. Let's have a little dance.
This
is Sean Tracy playing Old Black Crow. You're going to hear this in the movie Boyhood, playing this weekend at the Gold Town Theater, 586-2875, goldtownnick.com.
Hey.
Say hi to everybody
Colette
in Peru.
Costa, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For all you do and for all you show.
I got my lines in the water, and I ain't caught a fish all day, but I'm thinking about you, dear, and it's keeping the fishing blues away. Now the wind is howling, the water's getting rough, and I do believe I've had about enough. If the fish don't come, I don't know what I'll do.
On 360 North at 8 o'clock, join Arianna Huffington and Howard Feynman on Great Conversations. At 9, Unlikely Heroes of the Arab Spring argues that the uprisings were less political events and more about the coming of the Industrial Revolution to a region where over 90% of the people live and work outside the rule of law. Great Decisions in Foreign Policy leads off the weekly wrap-up at 10. It's a great way to look at public affairs on 360 North and 360north.org.
In tune with KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators in the Valley and Auk Bay. You can tune to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, it's K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM at 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion in Nicey Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9. We're also on GCI Cable on digital channel 87.
I learned to think, 'cause all I wanna
do is play the guitar and sing. And everything I know now I learned out on the road, and I've been damn near everywhere, but I got no place to go.
Pat Moore been your host today. Joan Pardis will be here on Monday, and she'll be talking with Assistant Fire Chief Ed Quinto about volunteer firefighter recruitment. Big Brothers Big Sisters Recruitment Development Director Lena Gilbertson will drop in. Girl Scouts Member Services and Program Specialist Tara Lee Ellis will be here. So tune in to Juno Afternoon on Monday with Joan Pardis hosting. Pat Moore been your host today for Juno Afternoon. Hope you enjoyed the show, and I'll be back next Friday.
Kill me one day at a time, every instant.